After his victory lap in Australia, Ian Dunt is making his way home, where Prime Minister Keir Starmer has decided to allow US fighter planes to use UK bases to pursue the forever war with Iran.
It's vital that we continue to focus on supporting Ukraine. We cannot allow the war in the Gulf to turn into a windfall for Putin. Now, it's clear the US operation has massively weakened the military capability of the abhorrent regime in Iran. The question is, what comes next?
Well, answer that question, Ian. What does come next, particularly for Starmer and Britain?
Well, I mean, bad things. I mean, the only proper description we can use is bad things, in that Iran has now very clearly and demonstrably recognized that it has powerful leverage as long as it's willing to accept a degree of national self-sacrifice. And by the time that the US purpose in its operation was regime change, and this became an existential crisis for the regime in Tehran, then they very quickly decided that they were prepared to put up with that level of self-sacrifice. And of course, what they've managed to do, basically through belligerence and threats, is close the Strait of Hormuz. And effectively through the impact, emotional and psychological, that those threats have on insurance and on the people on the shipping lanes. And that doesn't really lead you anywhere good. So Donald Trump looks increasingly desperate in his calls for other countries to help get him out of the problem that he has himself begun. And the UK and others, I mean, you know, Japan, Australia, Canada, France, there's really no one stepping up to say, we're going to help you on this particular aspect of what you're trying to do. And yet it's interesting that Donald Trump's emotional outbursts in response to that tend to be pointed more towards Keir Starmer than anyone else. And in fact, reaching a point where you sort of think it's almost like he's becoming his new bête noire. I mean, it's almost like he's becoming his new kind of primary antagonist. He really does seem to be genuinely emotionally upset at the fact that Keir Starmer has refused to do the things that he asked for. And that right there is probably one of the most singular accomplishments that I can make of the British Prime Minister.
But surely this goes to Starmer's standing in Britain.
Yeah, it helps him. I mean, to be honest, this is probably the single, it's almost like he's fallen into it, but it's basically the single most popular policy position he's ever adopted. And it's the bit that you couldn't, he almost seemed surprised. I mean, the first week, he wasn't really making hay out of it. The first week, when he basically said, look, you can't use our bases for offensive operations. This was classic sort of, you know, North London lawyer stuff, and advised by his attorney general, Richard Hammer, who basically said, look, you can't, it's not illegal. It's obviously not a legal war, so you can't do it. And then the second week they said, you can use it for defensive operations, almost certainly because the legal advice said, you know what, that probably is legal. And so he adopted the position on his instinctive process orientated legalistic interpretation, and then found, you know, was attacked as usual by the right wing press, by Kemi Badenoch, the Tory leader, by Nigel Farage, the reform leader. And then the next week just found, oh, actually, the public really like this point of view. Like, the public really don't believe in the war in Iran. They think it's a dreadful, shambolic, insane way to have behaved. They like the fact that Britain isn't going to get involved in this one. They generally think you've adopted the right position and that everyone else has adopted the wrong one. And now he's sort of flying. I mean, you know, as far as Starmer goes, this is all comparative, of course. His personal approvals are still like, you know, minus 30 or something like that. But nevertheless, he's flying higher than he usually is just by having stumbled into the correct policy position.
But Starmer has allowed the use of UK bases for American planes. Now, what's that about?
Yeah, so this is his core explanation, which is that we will allow for defensive operations. I happen to disagree with this, but let me put the position as it was put to me by those who are more sympathetic, which is essentially to say, The US military command operates largely independently from the US political command. They have worked with British forces for decades. If we tell them our red lines, for instance, this can only be used for, you know, defensive operations, no offensive operations, they will stick to those red lines. If Britain doesn't allow for those planes to be operating on a defensive posture that is essentially saying to our allies in the Middle East, and indeed our own assets in the Middle East and our own bases in the Middle East, for instance, like in, actually even outside of the Middle East, even in places like Cyprus, that's essentially saying, well, we're going to leave you as sitting ducks because we happen to disagree with the operation that was taken. Whereas in fact, the position should be, you know, we will make sure that we're protecting our assets. I personally, my view is that I don't think that we should be facilitating any kind of American operations, and that using our own assets is qualitatively different to allowing the US to use ours for what has to be interpreted as a necessary step in their prosecution of the war. But there are a lot of people who oppose the war in general and British involvement in general who do support the Starmer position, both in and out of the Labour Party, and saying that really it's not a very satisfying middle ground that he's occupied in terms of sort of logic or morality, but it is pretty much the only ground that he could possibly have found.
Are the far-right parties in the UK, as they are in Australia, essentially arguing that we should send in troops?
Well, initially, yes. So Nigel Farage's first position was, why aren't we supporting the Americans? What have we done to the special relationship? And by the way, it wasn't just him. You look at, you know, magazines like The Spectator saying, you know, this profound day of humiliation for Britain that it wasn't directly involved in the initial attacks. It's worth just thinking for a moment, by the way, about what this means, about just how thin their patriotic veneer so truly is, because they don't even, they can't possibly be expecting a decent explanation of why we would be going to war, because none have been provided to the American people, let alone to the British or the Australian people. You know, there are no coherent explanations that are offered to us as to what on earth is going on or what the goals are. So their position on the right is essentially to say, you should join whatever it is that the Americans want you to join, no matter how vulnerable, no matter the impact on, you know, British national security, on the lives of British service personnel. And you should do it without even being able to explain what you're trying to achieve or what the conditions would be by which you would finish the operation. Because, of course, you cannot articulate that because no one told you what we're doing there in the first place. So the right-wing position, on a patriotic basis, on the basis of the values which it itself is supposed to uphold, has become terribly, terribly weak. And yet it only lasted for that first week. Because by the time you got to early March, you already had this very clear sight. The public were against the war. You saw instantly the impact on petrol prices. And suddenly, Nigel Farage, the absolute staggering chutzpah of the man, then comes out and starts saying, well, our new campaign is on why we've got to reduce the price of petrol. And you just think, like, if you had had your way, the price of petrol would be even more out of control than it is right now on the basis of the war that you said we should enter into before you'd even understood what it was that you were talking about. So, I mean, it really is a absolutely ham-fisted, terribly pitiful position that he's put himself in. And on that really core issue of your basic judgment, if you want to be prime minister, on your basic judgment on the biggest matters that a prime minister can make judgments on, he's shown himself to be very weak indeed.
But does this allow Starmer to be more of a leader than he's been before? Is Starmer capable of actually making hay?
Not in the long run. None of this stuff can sort of save him, I don't think. I do think it's almost a sort of a curiosity that he's ended here. You know, whenever there's another news story that flitters up, for instance, we've got some more details about the Peter Mandelson story this week, where when you looked at the internal documents about Starmer's decision making, the internal documents, the stuff that was never supposed to come to light, there are just whole areas that he's not saying anything, where he's basically just clearly not involved in the process. He's handed it over, you know, in that case to his chief of staff. And he's basically this absent man, this sort of clothing without a human body to inhabit it, on a purely administrative level, that corresponds pretty much with the things that seem to make him so ineffective at the job. So the basic personal attributes that he has are still there. The lack of charisma is still there. The sort of sense, that listless feeling of just having no direction, no real core values to guide you, all of that is still there with him. He is still not a good prime minister and will not make one. But on this issue, I think, well, you know, when his time as prime minister ends, which I still think won't be too long now, this will be one of those issues that we look at and we're like, he got that right. And you know what? Something else. None of his immediate predecessors would have got it right. You know, there's no way Rishi Sunak got that right. There's no way Boris Johnson got it right. There's no, I mean, Liz Truss, you know, probably would have had us launch the nukes. So, I mean, on that basis, you sort of think, like, thank God, at least now, thank God, he is the person in charge and not any of the other people that we've had for the last 15 years.
But Ian, that photograph of Mandelson sitting around a curiously empty table, with Epstein and with Prince Andrew, doesn't it speak well for all three of them? Because you can just see the fun they're having. They don't seem to have a drink in their hands. Some of them have got bathrobes on. Some of them have got clothes. But it just looks such fun, Ian. How can you complain about it?
It's a bit of the trouble is, when you see their emails, you just think these people are just beyond the obvious moral depravity and corruption. They're just so witless. You know, the emails are just like the worst kind of like, you know, sort of dreadful uncle just sending round a round robin joke that he heard somewhere in the office. Just so tedious. And when you see those photos, quite apart from anything else, you just think, I'm sure that conversation was unbelievably tedious for anyone to have had to sit through and wouldn't have been eased in any social way by virtue of the fact that they are wearing bathrobes.
And there is the question of who is taking all these photographs and why?
Yeah.
I mean, are the photographs being taken in order to lock these people in?
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking the same thing. And it's funny how often they seem like they really kind of trap them. Look, I obviously don't – I have to put a health warning on this because I have no evidence to show that this is the case. But it's – and, of course, the images that we are seeing from the collections are always the ones that are most incriminating and most humiliating because, obviously, those are the ones that get the most traction. But it's quite hard to escape that sense that there was a conscious effort to make sure that those kinds of photos were possessed in, you know, just in case these relationships ever became fractious in future.
And I'm sure Donald Trump, amongst all people, is the most unhappy that the war is taking our attention away from the Epstein matter.
Yeah, exactly. And this absurd, you know, I mean, just again, having just, look, this has been, I mean, now this is such a cliche that it's even become a joke at the Oscar awards, you know, the other night. But essentially to say that, like, at least there is a process happening in Britain to investigate people that are attached to these matters. Whereas in the US, you just get this sense that any kind of basic, consistent, universal application of justice has now crumbled almost completely. And it really is very, very hard for any of them to get any kind of secure purchase on Donald Trump on these matters, even though they directly contradict pretty much all of the statements that he made before he came to power, and indeed any kind of normal moral sense as to how you conduct yourself in public.
Ian, thanks for joining us on the show.
Not at all. Thank you.
I've been talking once more to Ian Dunt, columnist with The Eye, author of the book How Westminster Works and Why It Doesn't.